Sanctions against Iraq are the most complete and total blockade of any country in modern history. What this has really been about, and the reason that the Iraqi people have had such a terrible toll inflicted on them, is that this is part of establishing and strengthening the U.S. corporate hold on a part of the world that they consider more key, more strategic, more economically important than any other. And that's the Gulf region, the Middle East, because it has two-thirds of the world's oil resources.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, February 22nd, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, Freak Radio's C-Line will be speaking with Isha Williams, author of the new book, Grassroots Journalism. And later on, we'll hear from Richard Becker of the International Action Center on the situation in Iraq and the movement to end the more than 10 years of U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Thursday, February 22nd, 2001. About 300 workers and their families began a sit-down protest Friday, February 16th, inside the Daewoo Motor Company's main plant in Bupyeong, South Korea, after the financially ailing company laid off 1,751 workers. The layoffs were part of efforts to make Daewoo Motors more attractive to General Motors, who began negotiations to take over the plant in September 2000. By Saturday, 300 more workers who slipped past police lines joined the sit-in. Thousands of riot police raided the plant on Monday using forklifts to break down the front gate and end the four-day protest. Workers fought back, however, wielding steel pipes and hurling rocks and Molotov cocktails before dispersing and hiding inside the auto plant. Some workers also hosed water across the steel gate onto police, who in turn hosed down the workers with a fire truck. At least one worker was taken to the hospital. About 60 protesters were detained by police. This clash is yet another in a series of violent episodes between police and Daewoo workers that have occurred since the company collapsed during the 1997-98 Asian financial crisis. Also on Monday, 34 Daewoo Group executives and accountants were indicted for being involved in a multi-billion dollar slush fund. Members of the environmental group Earth First occupied the new Staples office supply store in Atlanta, Georgia on Saturday, February 17th, to protest the company's use of non-recycled paper. More than 60 people came to participate in the action, which included a banner drop from the store's roof. Protest organizers claim that 97% of the paper products currently sold by Staples are made from virgin wood fiber. Protesters gathered in the parking lot before entering the store, chanting and carrying signs. 8 activists blocked the paper aisle, with 4 on each end locking down. Police arrived a short time later and told all protesters to vacate the premises. Most of those demonstrating moved outside to the front of the business. The police officers apparently were at a loss as to how they would de-link the arms of the protesters, which were chained together inside of heavy-gauge metal pipes. Eventually, the 8 protesters in lockdown were arrested and removed from the store with their arms still linked. The activists voluntarily unlocked before entering the police van for transportation to the Atlanta City Jail. They were charged with misdemeanor criminal trespass and felony obstruction of justice. Around 30 people gathered outside the entrance to the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute on Wednesday, February 21st, to raise concerns about biotechnology. Inside the Humphrey Institute, a luncheon of biotech industry leaders was held, and as Syngenta CEO Edward Shaughnessy was beginning to speak, the activists stormed the foyer. They chanted, "You cannot govern genetic drift," as one activist had a handheld siren and another cranked a boombox playing anti-biotech music from a Brazilian punk rock band, making it impossible for the speech to be heard. The small group of activists managed to halt the luncheon without arrest, since the police on hand took no action to stop the protest. The luncheon's participants were forced to retreat to a nearby auditorium to finish their meeting. And finally, on Thursday, February 22nd, the Zoning Board of the City of Santa Cruz postponed a vote on a controversial use permit to install a Sprint PCS wireless communications facility on the roof of a hotel in the Beach Flats, a densely populated neighborhood of mostly low-income Latin Americans. Concerned about the effects of potentially harmful electromagnetic radiation, a half dozen residents turned out to address the board.
Headaches, eye discomfort, facial redness, ringing or high-pitched sounds, fatigue, dizziness, sleep disturbances, irregular heartbeat, high blood pressure, nausea, pain in the joints, difficulty in concentrating, memory difficulties, immune system abnormalities, asthma, allergies, etc. The culprit, a cellular communications tower.
To date, there is no conclusive scientific study on the effects of cell phone antennas. The firm of Hammett and Edison, consulting engineers retained on behalf of Sprint, issued a statement recommending the application be approved. Shoshone Smith is a resident of the neighborhood and is somewhat skeptical of the study.
They don't know if it's safe. They're assuming it's safe. They're going by some studies that support that idea that maybe it's safe. But like I say, there's a gray area, and they know there's a gray area, so they have to word it that way.
Mike Ferry is a planning consultant for the city of Santa Cruz. While he supports the plan for the antenna, he says the city's hands are tied because of the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
As long as they're operating within the guidelines of the FCC, that we can't regulate these for health purposes.
While a number of these antennas already exist in the city, none are located in such a dense residential neighborhood. In the meantime, members of the Zoning Board want more information and will reconvene on Thursday, March 8th, to bring this issue to a vote. And those were headlines for the week ending Thursday, February 22nd, 2001. Grassroots Journalism, a new book about community-based reporting authored by Isha Williams, is a practical manual for doing the kind of writing that doesn't just get people angry, but active, that doesn't just inform, but inspires. Freak Radio's C-Line recently spoke with Isha about his new book, available through Apex Press. He begins with a critique of mainstream media news coverage.
Effectively advocates passivity. Of course, you don't see them writing editorials saying don't vote or, you know, don't get involved in local politics, but the effect of mainstream media coverage equals that. Specific kind of issues that people might want to get active on and don't, in part because of media coverage, might be joining labor unions. Obviously, income inequality and the growing divide between rich and poor in America is a big problem, and the labor movement is probably the best single way to address that, to join unions at one's workplace and organize with one's fellow workers. If you just read the corporate media, like the New York Times or CNN or your local Santa Cruz Sentinel or San Francisco Chronicle, San Jose Mercury News, I believe it is, they're all more or less the same with regards to their coverage of unions, and that is to say that 99% of their coverage of unions, more or less, is about strikes. Even though that the exact opposite is true, that unions only strike about 1% of the time during contract negotiations. The vast majority of the time when unions negotiate with employers, they negotiate a successful contract that results in increases in wages and better benefits and more of a voice in the workplace for their members. So unions are a good thing for working people, and you wouldn't know that by reading the corporate media or watching CNN or listening to the corporate TV. You'd get the impression that they're greedy and corrupt and that they're always going on these confrontational strikes for no good reason but to cause trouble. Virtually every daily newspaper in the United States has a business section. In some cases, the business section is as thick or thicker than the news section. The New York Times is frequently the business section, maybe 40 pages here in the New York edition. And then the news section, which includes national and international news, is, you know, less than that, may only be 30 or 35 pages. And that says something about the priorities of the paper. There's no labor section at all, and most working people don't own businesses. They don't trade stock, or at least not enough stock to know what kind they own. They work for a wage, and you wouldn't know that by reading the New York Times. You wouldn't see the majority of Americans' daily concerns, their daily interests. How can they get a better wage? How can they get a decent public school for their kids? How can they get access to health care? How can they have a decent, clean environment in their community, and how they can make those things happen? You don't see those things discussed in the Times by and large. There's exceptions to anything I'll say, but in general, you'll read about stocks and that the economy's doing well or economy's not doing so well. But the economy, often when they say it's doing well, that means it's not doing well for workers. It means that corporate profits are up. That's what it means in the New York Times, that the economy's doing well. And when corporate profits are up, that's generally because they're making their workers work harder for less pay.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the reason for this, for media's anti-worker, anti-activism bias?
I don't think there's any room where, you know, there's these bunch of white men in business suits kind of pull down the shades and plot about how they're going to screw the working class. But the result is the same. It's just their interest. If you look at the owners of the mass media, and they operate their business for the purpose of increasing their own profits, number one. Newspapers are notoriously bad to their own employees in terms of union relationships, and that's because of the fact that the number one goal of the owners of those newspapers is not to promote grassroots activism, which is the basis of democracy. Their number one goal is to maximize profits, and they'll tell you that. They're not ashamed of that fact. And maximizing profit doesn't always, in fact, it generally doesn't coincide with the interests of working class people, which is to expand democracy and to expand economic equality and to limit pollution by big companies, including newspaper companies, I might add. Obviously, they have to cut down a lot of trees to make those newspapers, so they don't want high taxes on logging. They want to have access to our national forest to log them, which they do.
So grassroots journalism is a solution to counter this media bias. And how would you define what grassroots journalism is?
Well, it has a lot to do with deciding what you write about, and it depends, who you ask that. If it's the editor of a newspaper, it's deciding what they'll assign their reporters. If it's a journalism student at UCSC or another college, it's deciding where they're going to work. Are they going to choose to try and get a job at a corporate media outlet like the Santa Cruz Sentinel, or are they going to work maybe for a Pacifica station like KPFA in Berkeley or another non-corporate, independently owned news outlet, or like Free Radio Santa Cruz? Obviously, the limits on what they can talk about are going to be a lot lower and more restrictive at a corporate news outlet, for all the reasons I discuss in the book. So grassroots journalism means trying to find the issues that are most likely to get your readers active in a community. Those generally aren't the issues you're going to read about in the New York Times or here on CNN. They may be, how come there's no decent-paying manufacturing jobs left in America and everything we buy seems to be made in China? They may be, how come we can't get universal health care? Every other industrial country in the world has universal free health care, and we don't. Those are the kind of things. And then finding solutions that have worked at a local level in other places. You know, if it's the case of how to get more better health care, it may mean finding out which unions have succeeded in organizing janitors in another city like Santa Cruz and how they managed to get health care for their members, for low-income people, how people fought to open a health care clinic, like free access to health care. It means writing about those issues in a way that your main goal is to get the reader or the listener, if you're on radio, to get them fired up and angry about the current state of affairs, but also hopeful that they could make a difference if they get involved and hopefully, ideally, give out a phone number, a time and a place of where the group will be meeting, where some grassroots group will be meeting to plan some kind of activism, because that's where it all starts.
From the studios of 96.3 FM Freak Radio in Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to the Weekly Freak Show. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. Up next, I'll be speaking with Richard Becker about the situation in Iraq. But first, this week's Spotlight Sound. Here's Propagandhi with the song Albright Monument Baghdad from their latest release titled Today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes.
Damage. Waiting to be happening. It's a mark for scene.
It is estimated that 5,000 Iraqi children ages 5 and under die every month as a direct result of U.S.-imposed economic sanctions. On Friday, February 16th, U.S. and British jets attacked some 25 sites outside of the southern no-fly zone near Baghdad, killing 2 people. The bombing aroused worldwide condemnation as international governments criticized the bombings and mass demonstrations protesting U.S. aggression against the Iraqi people sprang up around the globe. U.S. warplanes again bombed air defenses in northern Iraq on Thursday, February 22nd, despite the fact that some smart bombs missed their targets in last Friday's raid. Thursday's attacks came as U.S. and British leaders struggled under criticism to develop a new policy toward Baghdad. Richard Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the International Action Center. He has visited Iraq twice, in 1993 and more recently in January 2000. I spoke with Richard about the conditions in Iraq as a result of the bombings and more than 10 years of economic sanctions.
To go to Iraq is really a searing experience for anyone, I think, who opens their eyes to what's going on there, who goes to the hospitals, who goes to the communities, who sees the condition of a society that was once a thriving society and one of the more developed countries in the developing world, and has now been reduced by a human-made, a deliberately made catastrophe to a condition that is about the same as the poorest countries in the entire world. When you talk about things like infant mortality and indices of stunting and wasting among children, there's been massive death due to the sanctions. At least 1.5 million people who would otherwise be alive today, and that's important to note, not just a gross total of deaths, but 1.5 million people who would otherwise be alive today, half of them children under the age of 5, have died as a result of the sanctions, and that's by many, many different estimates. And it's a horrific thing to see, and it's what makes it even more horrific is to know that it is, in fact, a human-created catastrophe, and that the main creators of that catastrophe are the people who are the leaders of the United States. The sanctions against Iraq are the most complete and total blockade of any country in modern history. And those aren't my words or Ramsey Clark's words, but those are the words of Sandy Berger, who was the former National Security Advisor. He said that about 3 years ago, and he said it proudly. Well, it's nothing to be proud of. It's something to be deeply ashamed of, and in fact, it constitutes a crime against humanity because of the way that it's been imposed. On August 6, 1990, 4 days after Iraq went into Kuwait, these sanctions were imposed. This blockade was imposed. It's been enforced by military means ever since. For the first 6 years after it was imposed, Iraq had virtually no trade at all, except for a trickle of smuggling along the borders, which didn't amount to much of anything. They bring it up now, but it's really not much. And it's important to realize that this is a country that was dependent on imports for 65% of its medicine and 70% of its food, and it paid for that by exporting oil. And up to 100% of its machinery, of its infrastructural goods, of things like chlorine to purify water, all kinds of foodstuffs, medicines, medical supplies, and so forth, were being imported by and paid for by that. So just imagine in the United States what the situation would be if we woke up tomorrow morning and we read on the headlines in the newspapers that all foreign trade had been ended. Well, how many thousands of points would the stock market? There would be no more question on whether it was a bull market or a bear market. The stock market would collapse. Millions of people would be laid off, and the country would be thrown into a depression that would rival, if not surpass, the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that's in a country, the country that we live in, is one of the richest and most varied in terms of its resources of any on Earth. Iraq doesn't have that. Iraq has oil to export. It has some agriculture, of course. It has some other industry. But it was highly dependent on the export of oil, and that was cut off. In 1996, what's called the oil for food deal was developed. And that allowed Iraq to export a certain amount of oil and to then use the money, not Iraq used the money, but the United Nations used the money, because Iraq has never touched one penny of the money from the oil for food deal, but the money was deposited in the United Nations escrow account. Iraq then submits contracts to the United Nations committee, the 661 committee, named after the sanctions resolution. On that committee sits one member, one representative from each one of the countries that is currently on the Security Council. A difference with the Security Council and the 661 committee is that whereas five countries have a veto power on the Security Council, all 15 states that are represented have veto power. Any one of them can veto any of the contracts. So billions and billions of dollars, probably only a third of the money that has come, the revenue from the oil that has been sold, has actually come into Iraq in the last 5 years. And actually more money has gone to reparations to Kuwait and to transnational corporations than has come back to the people of Iraq. I think now is the time for us to increase our activism in every way possible, whether it's demonstrations or vigils or public meetings or many people are involved. That's not our particular focus on lobbying and so forth, but whatever people do, whatever people can do, now is the time to turn up the heat, because now is the time when the U.S. government is really getting pushed into a corner on this. I think what they'll try to do is come up with some kind of a formula, and this is being hinted at in the media, that makes it appear that they're backing down some on the sanctions, and they may have to allow more goods to be traded, which would be a victory. But at the same time, I think what they're going to try to do is to keep Iraq in a weakened and decimated state. Because really the objective of all this, the reason the sanctions have been there all this time, is for very different reasons than the ones that have been enunciated by the government. Their reasons, their stated reasons, are all false. It's not Saddam Hussein, it's not human rights, it's not UN resolutions. There's too much selectivity on all of those counts for us to find that believable. What this has really been about, and the reason that the Iraqi people have had such a terrible toll inflicted on them, is that this is part of establishing and strengthening the U.S. corporate hold on a part of the world that they consider more key, more strategic, more economically important than any other, and that's the Gulf region, the Middle East, because it has two-thirds of the world's oil resources. And that kind, those vast oil resources not only mean fabulous profits for the oil companies and the banks and so forth, but they also, control of them also, to a very large degree, is a determining factor in global geopolitical control. And so that's what makes this so important. And we should keep our eye on the ball, because even if they revise the sanctions policy, they are not going to revise this objective. This has been a fixed objective of U.S. policy now since World War II.
Can you just talk briefly about the International Action Center and the Iraq Sanctions Challenge? There was one that just returned a month or so ago from Iraq. Can you just talk a little bit about what people go over there to do and how that comes off?
Well, this was the fourth Iraq Sanctions Challenge. The first one was in May of 98, following the big crisis that happened during that winter when we came right to the brink of all-out war again. And at that time, we sent the biggest group, and there was a tremendous surge of activism then. We've sent four altogether. We've taken $7 to $8 million worth of medicine, which is great and is an act of solidarity, and it's important. You can't go there empty-handed, especially coming from the United States. We know at the same time there's no way that humanitarian relief is going to solve Iraq's problems. There's got to be an end to the sanctions. They have to be allowed to resume normal economic relations. There's no reason for them not to be. There's nothing that Iraq's done that's so exceptional that it should be excluded from for all this time, 10 years after it's been out of Kuwait. But it gives people from the United States a chance to see the reality, and it's been very important. I think it's been one of the main ways of increasing activism in the United States, that altogether probably 250 people have now gone on these delegations, and almost everybody who goes comes back and wants to tell their story and does tell their story. Some people go out and they speak in, you know, dozens of places. Some people just do a few. But it's been a way in which we've been able to break through the wall of silence, the wall that the media has built between the people in the United States and the people in Iraq, to not see this unbelievable suffering that people are going through. I mean, it's really incredible to see children who in schools who very much prize education in a country which had raised school attendance to about 98%. And it's fallen a lot. It's down 20% now. And it's fallen because there's no more chalk. there's no more school books. The desks are broken. Children sit on the floor. The rooms are dirty. There's nothing to clean. There's no cleaning fluids and so forth. There's no paper. There's no notebooks. I mean, you see this kind of thing, and you know that this is a country that was giving aid to other countries, to poorer countries in the Middle East and to Africa before this. You go to the hospitals, and you see that there are mothers that were there, and now, after years, some of these mothers are losing their second, third, and fourth children. And they're dying mainly because of the lack of clean water. They're dying because in Iraq gets very little rain. So it's dependent on its water for the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And in the Gulf War, all of the water and sewage treatment plants and electric plants and everything were deliberately bombed and destroyed, even though it had nothing to do with Kuwait, really. And that was a war crime, too. But they rebuilt things, but now they've run out of parts. Pipe has been, it's been impossible to import pipe, impossible to import chlorine and so forth. So you have this terrible situation where the sewage is going untreated into the rivers and the water is coming out untreated. And that combination is the main, that is the number one cause of death, particularly among children. So you see them now, there is a little bit more medicine. Things have improved slightly in the hospitals. There's more, a little bit more medicine. There's more than when I first went. When I first went in '93, it was just unbelievable. There was just nothing. But the infrastructural elements have been blocked by the 661 committee. The pipe, the chlorine, the electric inputs, the sewage, water treatment. A lot of these things they haven't been repaired. So even if you can bring the children into the hospital, you can treat them. And they, usually that's the kind of thing we take, antibiotics or anti-diarrheal medicines. And it saves tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives with that. But the reality is that then those children go home and they drink the same water again. And seeing this stuff firsthand, going to the Al-Amariya bomb shelter and seeing what was a deliberate attack where 2,000 people were killed, most of them boiled to death by the bursting of the boilers with the second missile that hit. There was no denial that it was a deliberate attack. You see these things, seeing these things firsthand really has a huge impact on people, and people come back, I think, very motivated to explain to others. And so that's part of what our project is. We joined the demonstration, our delegations, both this year and last year at 2 a.m. on January 17th, which was exactly the time that the bombing started. But it's a tremendous experience. We will probably do it again. Hopefully we'll do it again. It takes a lot of work to do it. But we really do urge people, if you can go to Iraq, to go and to see firsthand this tremendous crime against humanity that's being committed in our name.
And that's all for this week. Thanks for listening on Micropower 102.9 FM, BLR 104.1 FM, Free Radio Madison 87.9 FM, Free Radio Twin Cities 93.1 FM, Radio Free Cascadia 98.5 FM, KART 91.9 FM, KELI 90.7 FM, and on the web at unbrokenchain.net, partytown.com, and PerumpRadio.com. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can be reached at P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. And don't forget, you can listen to all the excellent programming on Freak Radio on our website by pointing your browser to www.microradio.net/frsc. That's www.microradio.net/frsc. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project for distribution, our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For C-Line and all the folks here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.